This is the 2017 Okanagan Central Year-End Studies. Our speaker is Brother Ryan King. His overall theme is the power of the Son of God. This is Class 2, the Holy One of God. Well, good afternoon, brothers and sisters. In our first session, we attempted to establish the reason for the Lord's miracles. And we saw how those miracles were used very carefully by Christ to outwork the purpose of his Father, so that each individual miracle, rather than being a display of power merely, was in fact a parable in and of itself to reinforce the Lord's teachings. There is a general connection in the scriptures between sin and disease. Adam and Eve sinned, and as a result of that, disease and death swept through the earth. There is that connection very often you find in the Bible between the two. He healeth all thy diseases. He forgiveth all thine iniquities. And because of that connection that the Bible clearly shows, the removal of the diseases was a sign that the Lord ultimately intended to remove not just the consequences of sin, but sin and death entirely. And in our first class, we endeavored to show how Mark carefully and skillfully weaves these miracles through his gospel record. That there must have been hundreds of miracles which the Lord performed during the early days of his ministry. But Mark only records 5. And they carefully oscillate between the synagogue and the house. So we'd like to have a look at those two miracles here, or those two places here in Mark chapter 1, where these miracles occur. Keeping in mind, brothers and sisters, that behind every one of the miracles, there's a parabolic and a symbolic import. If we recorded everything Jesus did, we'd run out of books. So why then do we just have these few? Let's see if we can uncover what the meaning of these things is. So in Mark chapter 1 and verse 21, we're told that the Lord went into Capernaum. Now Capernaum means the city of comfort. And it really was his headquarters in the north. It's called in Matthew chapter 9 and verse 1, his own city. It was the center of the fishing industry. It was a place where goods were taxed and levied. And when you spoke to Capernaum, brothers and sisters, you really spoke to the world. It was a hustle and a bustle of a place. And the Lord spent much time here, as we'll see in our studies. When you spoke to Capernaum, you spoke to the world. And the Lord went to that place. And verse 21 says, straightway, and there's that word euthios, immediately on the Sabbath day, he entered into the synagogue and taught. This synagogue, of course, was a very famous synagogue, as we'll see in our studies. The synagogue in those days was the bastion of the law. It was the center of rabbinical exposition. It was, as it were, a miniature temple. It faced the same direction as the temple. It had the same general compartments as the temple. As a matter of fact, the scrolls, the boxes in which they kept the Word of God, were held or kept at the very front of the hall in a little box which they called the sanctuary. So when you moved into a synagogue, brothers and sisters, you were moving into a miniature temple. Well, the Lord goes in there and he taught. And verse 22 says, they were astonished. And the word astonished there means to be struck in the mind. It's the language of the battlefield. He struck them with the sword of the Spirit. I want you to notice that there are a few key words in this miracle which highlight the theme of what is going on. Verse 21, end of the verse. He entered into the synagogue and he taught. They were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them. Verse 27, what thing is this? What new doctrine is this? You see, it's a contest, brothers and sisters, between a new doctrine and an old. The doctrine of the rabbis versus the doctrine of the Son of God. This first miracle is a contest between those two. Now, not sure how familiar you are with rabbinical expositions in these days, but they were absolute drivel. Which a rabbi would get up and he would expound some minute part of the law. And then he would begin to quote Rabbi so-and-so and Rabbi so-and-so and all the decisions of the rabbis down through history had made on that point. And then he would begin to dissect the word, looking at every minute part of the word until the audience had gone to sleep. Not this man. There was authority in the Lord's words. I say unto thee, verse 22, for he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes. He wasn't one that got up and quoted Rabbi so-and-so and Rabbi so-and-so. There was authority here. I say unto thee. And that's why it says very significantly in verse 23, and there was in their synagogues a man with an unclean spirit. It wasn't his. It was theirs. It was the rabbis. It was the laws. It wasn't his. And it was in their synagogue that significantly we read in verse 23 that there was a man with an unclean spirit. Now I want you to notice the affliction that this man has. He's in the synagogue. He's trying to show that the doctrine of the Son of God is more powerful than the law. And more specifically, more powerful than the rabbinical expositions of the law. An unclean spirit. He wasn't a leper. Didn't have a fever. It was an unclean spirit. Now, a spirit is a disposition of mind. He had a mind that was unclean. He's in the synagogue, the center of rabbinical exposition. But those things had been incapable of cleansing his mind. Because as Hebrews 9 and verse 9 says, the law was unable to touch the conscience. The law could not get through and penetrate to the conscience. And in that place, which represented the law, which represented the rabbis, there was a man whose disposition, whose mind was unclean. He had been listening to the rabbis, no doubt, in previous times. He had obviously been looking for help, otherwise he wouldn't have been in that place. And so he came, and he found a man who could help him. But although he was there, brothers and sisters, there was authority. See, he had come looking for help. We know that because verse 24 says, "What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth?" You see, he was Jesus from Nazareth, one of the despised villages of the area, of the region. He was someone who came there looking for help, looking to have his mind cleansed. Instead, the Lord's discourse obviously was about judgment and repentance. And he cried out, verse 24, "What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth?" Rotherham says, "What have we in common?" He came there looking for help. He came there looking to have his mind cleansed. But he looked at that man and he saw between himself and that man a great gulf fixed. "What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One," notice this, "not of the law, not of rabbinical tradition, the Holy One of God." Here was a holiness that was in character, not something that was external, not something which was unable to touch the conscience, but a holiness in character. He had been listening to the rabbis expound ceremonial purification and ceremonial holiness. But this man's holiness was one of character. He was the Holy One of God. And he picked his way down to the front, looking for help. He was obviously seeking help, brothers and sisters, otherwise he wouldn't have been in that place. He perhaps would have found it difficult to weave his way past the rabbis and those who wanted to throw him out of the synagogue. And Jesus saw him. Could the Son of God conquer the carnal mind? Could he do what the law could not do and that it was weak through the flesh? Well, Jesus, in verse 25, rebuked him. And the word rebuke there is used of rebuking hurricanes. It was like a storm just unleashing itself in that synagogue. He had come looking for restoration. Instead, he found authority and judgment and a man who was so far above him. And so he cried out, and Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Hold thy peace and come out of him." A storm began to unleash itself in that man, and slowly the Lord was able to work the cure upon that man's mind. So what are we seeing, brothers and sisters, in this first miracle? We're seeing that in a place of rabbinical teaching, of rabbinical exposition, in the bastion of the law, we find a man whose mind could not be cleansed by that. It required something greater. It required the Holy One of God, not the law. And they were all amazed, verse 27. And they said, "What thing is this? What new doctrine is this? What thing is this? Just keep your hand here and come back to Exodus 16. What is it? Here in Exodus 16, in a context having to do with the Sabbath, we find that the people's reaction to Christ, the people who had not been cleansed by the law, their reaction was almost the same to the manifestation of God in the wilderness, the manna. What is it? In Exodus 16 and verse 15, and when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, margin, what is this? It's almost the same words as the people in the synagogue. What thing is this? What new doctrine is this? For they wist not what it was. You know, God did not call the manna, manna. God called it bread from heaven. It's called in Psalm 78, the bread of the mighty. Manna was what they called it. Okay, that was the people who didn't know what it was. They called it manna. That's not how God saw it. God saw it as the bread of the mighty, angel's food, says Psalm 78. And that was the reaction of the people to Messiah. What is this? What new thing is this? For with authority commandeth he even the unclean spirits, and they do obey him. Here was a man, brothers and sisters, who has the ability to conquer within us the carnal mind. And what the law could not do, he was able to do by working the cure upon that man's mind. You know, if the law, which was wholly just and good, was unable to touch the conscience, then certainly the rabbinical expositions, which had gone way, way away from the law in the days of Christ, certainly they had no effect either. So in this first miracle, we see a very powerful idea being brought forth, that it's only the Son of God that can cleanse the unclean mind of man. You know, Mark alone chooses this word, an unclean spirit. You come over to Luke 4, I want you to show you that Luke actually chooses a different word. See, one of the interesting things about the gospel accounts of Christ is they choose different words for the same affliction because they're following different themes and different ideas. Have a look at what Luke calls this man's affliction. Luke chapter 4 and verse 34. Or verse 33, just for a connection. And in the synagogue, there was a man which had a spirit of an unclean devil. Mark said, there was in their synagogue. You see, because Mark's trying to show the difference between Christ and the synagogue. What does Luke say? In the synagogue, there was a man which had a spirit of an unclean devil. Now, the word devil that Luke chooses, the word daemonion, is a general word. It's a word that's used of all different kinds of afflictions. It's used of dumbness. It's used of madness. It's used of blindness. It's used of lunacy. But Mark chooses a different word. He chooses the word unclean spirit, an unclean disposition of mind, because he wants to point out the fact that the law, as represented by the rabbis, was incapable of cleansing this man's mind. And he alone chooses that word to describe this man's affliction. Come back to Mark chapter 1. Now we come to the contrast. As we've all rightly been taught, good Bible study is based upon good Bible reading. Very few of us will ever be experts at Greek and Hebrew. You don't need to be. We can read the Bible and we can think. There's only two things, as I always say, that are required to be a good Bible student. That's the ability to read and the ability to think. Those are the only two things you need. Look at the way this is read, or this sounds back in Mark chapter 1 and verse 28. Because now Mark is going to contrast the first miracle that took place in the synagogue. Verse 28, and immediately, there's that word euthios, his fame spread abroad throughout all the region round about Galilee. And immediately, euthios, when they were come out of the synagogue, they entered into the house of Simon and Andrew. See, it's read as a contrast. He leaves the synagogue, the bastion of the law, and he goes into a different location. He goes into the house. Not just any house, but the house of the disciples. If the synagogue represents Jewish law, Jewish exposition, Jewish teaching, then what, brothers and sisters, does the house represent? Come over to 1 Timothy chapter 3. The house, as we all know, is a well-known symbol for the ecclesia. 1 Timothy chapter 3. They met from house to house, we're told, in the book of Acts. Read Aquila and Priscilla, the ecclesia that is in their house. The house is the symbol of the ecclesia. What the synagogue wasn't is now going to be seen in this house, the ecclesia. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the ecclesia of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. And so the house miracles, brothers and sisters, represent the ecclesia. And they represent more specifically the type of behaviors and the type of things that ought to be seen in the ecclesia. So when we come to the house miracles, we're going to find ministration, gratitude, bearing burdens, people trying to help one another. That's what we're going to find in these house miracles. The opposite to what you should see in what is seen in the synagogue, where there was confusion, where there was raging, where there was a man screaming at the front. The house represents the ecclesia. And the type of things that ought to be seen in the ecclesia will be seen in these house miracles. So what do we find? We come back to Mark chapter 1. Immediately he leaves the synagogue, he enters into the house. A contrast is being painted. The house of the disciples. And this time, the miracle is totally different. Totally different. If ever there was a contrast in miracles, it's between these two. In the first miracle, we saw a man screaming out, unleashing himself in the synagogue. And the Lord, with authority, drove the uncleanness out of that man's mind. Well, in this miracle, we find total gentleness, compassion. Let's read it. Verse 30. But Simon's wife's mother lay sick of a fever. Notice, it's not a mental condition. Her mind was clean. It's a bodily affliction. It's a different kind of disease, a different kind of problem. And immediately they tell him of her. So the Lord is very approachable. They tell him of her, and verse 31 says, and he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. You know, read verse 25 and 26, and then read verse 31. You'll see the contrast. Jesus rebuked him, hold thy peace, come out. When the unclean spirit had torn him and cried with a loud voice, he came out. Verse 31, and he came, and the Greek word means to draw nigh. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. And immediately the fever left her. Here was an elderly woman, not a young man. Here was a miracle of compassion, not of authority. Here was an elderly woman, doubtless a mother in Israel, a relative of the disciples, someone in the ecclesia. The Lord draws nigh, takes her by the hand, and slowly lifts her up. If the first miracle spoke of authority, the second miracle, brothers and sisters, speaks of gentleness. So we learn from the second miracle that true compassion, true service, can only be found in the ecclesia. And I want you to notice her response in verse 31. And she ministered unto them. You know, that she broke the rabbinical traditions. It was the Sabbath. And you weren't to do work on the Sabbath according to the rabbinical traditions. But there was no rebuke from Christ, because here was a service of grateful love, a service of appreciation, and she wanted to show that appreciation by ministration. It's the same word used in this chapter in verse 13, where it says, and the Elohim came and ministered unto Christ. It's used of work in the ecclesia, of grateful labor, So in this woman, brothers and sisters, we see the type of work that ought to be seen in the ecclesia. Ministration, not because we're told to do it, not because, well, if we don't do it, then the AB will be on top of us. Ministration because we want to serve our brothers and sisters, because we love them, because we're so grateful for what God has done for us, that we're going to work and work and work for that. That was what this woman wanted to show. And that's the type of behavior that ought to be witnessed in the ecclesia, which these house miracles bring out. You know, it's interesting that when you go back to look at the garments of the high priest in Exodus 28 and all their glory and beauty, they're called garments to minister in. All of their beauty, all of their exquisite value, God says, no, those garments are not there to be beheld. They're there to work in. That's what this woman was doing. It was a grateful appreciation for what Christ had done for her. And that's what we ought to have in our ecclesias. Workers. Not people whose lips are moving, but people whose feet are moving. Not lips, feet. That's what we want in the ecclesia. Grateful service and grateful love. So you see what these miracles, brothers and sisters, are doing. They're contrasting law and grace. The type of chaos and confusion that's seen in the synagogue with the grateful love and service that's seen in the ecclesia. Now, just in case that connection isn't quite driven home, come over the page to chapter 1, verse 39. And he preached, notice this, in their synagogues. It wasn't his, it was theirs. It was the rabbis, it was the lost. He preached in their synagogues throughout all Galilee and cast out devils, and there came a leper to him. So here we have another skillful connection by Mark. The miracle may or may not have taken place in the synagogue, but it's connected with the synagogue. He preached in their synagogues, and there came a leper. What's the connection in Matthew's gospel? No peeking. What's the connection in Matthew's gospel? Well, in Matthew's gospel, he gives his discourse on the mount. He comes down from the mount. The first thing he meets is the leper. This miracle is the first miracle in Matthew's gospel. It's the third miracle in Mark's gospel. You see, each gospel writer is painting a little bit of a different picture of Christ's work. Mark's picture is, he preached in their synagogues and there came a leper. See, it's a different emphasis because Mark's highlighting a different point than Matthew. He preached in their synagogues and there was one that was totally despised, a total outcast in the eyes of society, a leper. If an unclean spirit was bad in the first miracle, a leper was considered to be worse. You could not come within 6 feet of a leper. And if you were downwind, the rabbi said you couldn't come within 150 feet of a leper. The law could do nothing for the leper. But what could the Son of God do for the leper? Verse 40, and there came a leper to him, beseeching him, kneeling down to him and saying unto him, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. You see, there's an uncertainty in his mind. You know, is this man like the rabbis? Because the rabbis had done nothing to help him. Maybe he's just like the rabbis, or can he help me with my problem? It's difficult, brothers and sisters, to overemphasize how much lepers were ostracized. They were the absolute downcast of society. If we come back to Leviticus 13, just show you what the law said about leprosy. Because the law actually gives us the interpretation of what leprosy represents. It was a gruesome and a fearsome disease where the skin begins to rot. An acceleration of mortality on foot. Leviticus 13, verse 3. And the priest shall look on the plague in the skin of the flesh. And when the plague is turned white, and the plague in sight be deeper than the skin of the flesh, it is a plague of leprosy. And the priest shall look on him and pronounce him unclean. So here's an affliction, brothers and sisters, that's in the flesh. It's deeper than the skin. But not only is it deeper than the skin, verse 7 says, but if the scab spread much abroad in the skin, the Hebrew is spread. After that he hath been seen of the priest for his cleansing, he shall be seen of the priest again. And if the priest see that, behold, the scab spreadeth in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprosy. So this is an affliction that not only is in the skin, but a disease that's breaking out, that's unrestrained. It's an apt symbol, brothers and sisters, of sin in the flesh. And the fact that finally it led to death, it was a perfect symbol of sin in all of its grotesqueness in the flesh. If we look at verse 14, we see that finally, when raw flesh appears, he shall be unclean. It represents, as Brother Robert says in the Law of Moses, active sin. Sin that is breaking out and is unrestrained in a person's life. That is the plague of leprosy. A person keeping the law, a person keeping the ceremonial requirements, would never have gotten leprosy. Leprosy came about because you neglected to do what God had asked you to do in the washings. It represented active sin. Now, can the law do anything about that? The priest could look upon it. They could tell you where you're going wrong in life and emphasize the lessons of holiness and separation. But that's all they could do. They could diagnose. To cure it required something much greater. Come back to Mark chapter 1 and we'll see just what that is. The rabbis, of course, had taken the demands of the law to an unmerciful limit. Lepers were total outcasts. But was the Lord Jesus Christ going to be any different? Verse 40. There came a leper to him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him, and saying unto him, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. He knew Jesus had the power, but was he willing? Is the Lord really interested in me? With all of my sins, with all of my problems, is the Lord really interested? Now, I want you to notice it says in verse 41, and Jesus moved with compassion. It doesn't say the Lord. It doesn't say Christ. It says, and Jesus. You see, that's the name of the man who bore our nature. For we see Jesus made a little lower than the angels. Whenever the New Testament writers talk about the man who identified with us, they use the term Jesus. Looking unto Jesus who endured the cross. And Jesus moved with compassion. The Greek word means to show bowels of pity. The law couldn't do that. All the law could do was to expel you from the camp. The rabbis had shown the man the law couldn't help. But here was one who could show bowels of pity. And it says he put forth his hand and he touched him. And doubtless that was the first time that man had ever been touched. He had not been touched for who knows how long. The Lord puts forth his hand and he identifies with that man's affliction, knowing that he's got an affliction that represents the disease in our nature that's going to bring us down to death. And he said, I will. Be thou clean. He put forth his hand. You know, it's the same expression that was used back in verse 31. Let me show you something about that hand. Come back to Isaiah 52. This is what was extended to him on this occasion. It's what's extended to us as well. Isaiah 52 and verse 10. Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. So who is this holy arm of Yahweh? He's made it clear in the sight of all nations. Well, who is it? Chapter 53, verse 1. Who hath believed our report? And to whom is the arm of Yahweh revealed? The arm of Yahweh is Messiah. Your arm is an extension of your being. The Lord was an extension of his Father, and he put forth that arm and touched not just anyone. He touched a leper. The previous verse, ignore the chapter breakup, Isaiah 52, verse 15, "So shall he sprinkle many nations, and kings shall shut their mouths at him." You'll know that that word "sprinkle" there was the very word that was used in the cleansing of the leper, where the leper would be sprinkled. It was a part of his cleansing process. Here was the cleansing process, not of law, but of God's servant, the one who was his holy arm, an extension of his own being, now being put forth for mankind. And this man is receiving that holy arm that he might be saved from this dreadful affliction that all men suffer from. You'll notice the end of verse 15 says, and wasn't this the reaction in the synagogue? "For that which hath not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. What thing is this? What man is this?" they said. Well, here he was, the Holy One, not of the law, but the Holy One of God. So here we see that not just does the Son of God have the power to control the unclean mind of man, but the most dreadful of all afflictions, sin being unrestrained in our flesh, can be overcome and can be controlled by him. We come back to Mark chapter 1, and he told this man to do something very deliberate. Having shown the great power that he has, which the law could not do, and that it was weak through the flesh, he said, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." Now, why did the Lord do that? Well, the end of the verse says, "For a testimony unto them." It wasn't that he sent him off to the priest because the law would have been, you know, the law had to be performed in order for him to be cleansed. It was for evidence, for a testimony unto the priest, that they might see all of these miracles, that the things which the law could not cure, which the law could not fix, are now being fixed. And I want you to go show yourself to the priest. Why? Not for yourself, for a testimony unto them. If they are God's appointed witnesses, if they are the ones who are able to ascertain who is of God and who is not of God, then they should be able to look at you and look at the change in your life, having outcast you from this synagogue before. They should be able to recognize who I am. Now, sadly, the man didn't go and do that. Verse 45, Jesus told him to go to the priest, not to tell anyone. Verse 45, "But he went out and began to publish it much and to blaze abroad the matter, insomuch that Jesus could no more openly enter into the city, but was without in desert places." You know, that's where they put the lepers. Without. In desert places. Outside the camp. Outside the synagogue. Now the Lord's out there with the lepers. And he was the one that was able to effect the cure. They had to go outside the camp to find him. And the end of Mark's gospel says, "And they came to him from every quarter." I hope as we go through these studies, brothers and sisters, you won't look at these miracles the same way again. You won't see the gospel of Mark the same way again. There is an absolute contrast in these miracles being painted between the rabbis, between the weaknesses of the law and the power of the Son of God. If his power, brothers and sisters, was great then it certainly is greater now. And we would do good to come to know him better, to come to love him better, because his power is able to conquer in our lives what the law could not do. He, through his teaching and through his love for us, is able to conquer the unclean spirit in man. Now I want you to notice chapter 2, verse 1. "And again, he entered into Capernaum." Now that was some time later, because it says, "after some days." It was some time later, the Lord goes back to Capernaum. You know, Mark just brushes aside the gap of time between the third miracle and the fourth miracle, and he says, "and again." And I know words like that are sometimes words that we just sort of gloss over and think, well, what comes next? But that word "again" is a very important word, particularly in Mark's gospel. I'll just give you a few illustrations. We come back to chapter 1, verse 16. Chapter 1 and verse 16. Now as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. And then if we come over to chapter 2, verse 13. And he went forth again by the seaside. See, that's Mark's connecting word. It's asking us to go back to the first time he was walking by the seaside. Chapter 4 and verse 1. Here we find this word again. And he began again to teach by the seaside. And there was gathered unto him a great multitude. Chapter 1 in verse 23. This is Mark's way of connecting incidents to his gospel. Chapter 1, verse 23. And there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. Then if we come over to chapter 3 and verse 1, and he entered again into the synagogue, and there was a man there which had a withered hand. You see, in that miracle, the cycle is complete. He started in the synagogue in chapter 1. He came again into the synagogue, and there the cycle was completed. Chapter 2 and verse 15. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in his house, many publicans and sinners sat also together with Jesus and his disciples. And then if we look over at chapter 3, verse 19, and Judas Iscariot, which also betrayed him, they went into an house, and the multitude cometh together again, so that they could not so much as eat bread. So in one house they could eat bread, in the next house they could not. So that little word again is very, very critical. It's Mark's way of connecting incidents. In chapter 2, verse 1, and again he entered into Capernaum, and it was noised that he was in the house. So Mark is asking us in chapter 2 and verse 1 to go back to the first occasion when he went to the house. When was that? Well, if you just come back to chapter 1 and verse 32. Chapter 1, verse 32. And at even, when the sun did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased, and them that were possessed with devils. And all the city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many that were sick of divers diseases, and cast out many devils, and suffered not the devils to speak, because they knew him. Now, whatever that's about, that is the connecting link that Mark makes in chapter 2, because he goes back to the same house, to the same door, and the crowds are there once more. Now, what's the import of chapter 1 and verse 32? At even, the sun did set. Now, it's obvious that at even, the sun sets. But Mark's pointing out that detail. At even, when the sun did set. You see, the Jewish day was coming to an end. The Sabbath was just about over. And at even, when the sun was setting, these enormous crowds packed into the house. Mark is specific in saying, verse 32, all that were diseased. Verse 33, and all the city was gathered together at the door. So the Jewish day is closing. The sun is setting. Now, when we take out our concordances and have a look at that language, and the sun did set, we find that almost invariably in the Bible, that phrase is used of those in far-off lands, the Gentiles. Malachi says, from one Sabbath to another, from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And you frequently find in the Psalms, Psalm 113 is another place, the connection between the sun setting and the Gentiles. The Jewish day is closing. The rituals of the law have come to an end. And over in the West, there is this crowd that's packing in to hear the word of God and to come to the Son of God. It's a picture, brothers and sisters, of the Gentiles being called into the truth. And where are they? Well, they're not in the synagogue. The Gentiles are in the house, because the ecclesia is open, as we know, to both Jews and Gentiles, all who will come to God by grace. I want you to notice also, brothers and sisters, the connection that's made in verses 32 and 33. Just to solidify that point that we're talking about the Gentiles and all men coming to the Son of God. Verse 33. And all the city was gathered together at the door. But you know, verse 32 says, they brought unto him. Did you see the point? Verse 32, they brought unto him. Verse 33, they were gathered at the door. Who's the door? It's him. It's the Lord Jesus Christ. And the door, as we know, is a well-known symbol for the Lord himself. And Mark here is depicting a time that as the Jewish day was closing, when the door of faith would swing open to the Gentiles, and they would pack into that house. Just come over to John chapter 10 and verse 9. Because the door is a well-known symbol for the Lord himself. They brought unto him, they were gathered at the door. And there's that connection between the Lord and the door. He is the one through whom we enter the house. In John chapter 10 and verse 9. I am the door. Notice this. By me, if any man, Jew or Gentile, any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out of the house and find pasture. And later on in this chapter, he talks about other sheep, verse 16, that I have, which are not of this fold, which we know to be a reference to the Gentiles. So in this dramatic background to Mark's fourth miracle, we see the point that he's trying to make. That Mark is now taking his horizon beyond the Jews to the time when the door of faith would swing open to the Gentiles, as Acts chapter 14 says, and they would pack into that house. Now it's in that context we come back to Mark chapter 2. He goes back to the same house, to the same door, and the crowds are once more there. And again, chapter 2, verse 1. And straightway, chapter 2, verse 2, many were gathered together, insomuch that there was no room to receive them, no, not so much as about the door. And he preached the word unto them. Now, Mark has now developed the stage a little bit further. You see, in the first event, when they came to the door, the people came just to be healed. Now we find that that door has been swung open. They're in the house. And why are they there this time? He's preaching the word to them. They've now gone beyond just healing. He's now preaching the word to them. And that is the dramatic background to Mark's fourth miracle, which, God willing, we'll consider in our next class.